If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret. Searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
From too much love of living, from hopes and dreams set free, we thank with breath, thanksgiving, whatever God's may be. Everyone is broken and everyone is whole, but in these narrow places, hold on to your soul. So close your eyes and listen, your road unfolds and glistens. If reason need there be, 'cause no one lives forever, and fortunes rise up never, and even the slowest river winds ever to the sea.
So waste no lifetime striving, the earth doesn't try to turn, just be in here and loving, and let your fire burn. And why scan the horizon for flaws in the sun rising? Easy come the blessings if your heart can turn. River winds ever to the sea.
We were made for love. We were made for love.
What we came here for, it was not for hate, it was not for war, 'cause it isn't a war game, a more game, a score game. If gimme is your name, there's too much to lose. We get confused, forget to choose the way that gets us to better. We've done this forever, and we don't remember. We're in this together, and we were made for love.
We were made for love.
Hold on to this connection, it's all that we are. We got the grace and vision from the sacred medicine. Transform the condition, it's a soul expedition. Hearts in darkness in need of healing. Occupy and magnify the loving feeling. Can't name it, tame it, contain or explain it, but raise up the flame for it, 'cause we were made for love.
We were made for love. We were made for love.
Thank you.
listening to Slowest River and Made for Love from the Ace of Cups, featuring Jackson Browne from their latest release, Sing Your Dreams. Everything old is new again. Well, kind of. Back in the late 60s, during the Haight-Ashbury scene of San Francisco, several bands emerged and caught fire. Bands like Big Brother and the Holding Company, Jefferson Airplane, and yes, the Grateful Dead. They all emerged from a scene of fantastic music, demonstrations, peace, love, and happiness. Well, if you're a listener to this show, I'm sure you know the story. Not all the bands of the day, though, garnered as much success as the trio I mentioned, and several didn't even make it out with an album deal at all. Amongst those bands that played the same stages as the higher profile acts were a quintet of women known as the Ace of Cups. They've had a bit of a resurgence over the last few years with a debut record, some 50 years in the making, and now a subsequent album 2 years out from that debut. Rather than telling you the story myself, we caught up with Denise Kaufman, one of the members of Ace of Cups, to get the details on the history of the band, both past and present. Our conversation started when I asked Denise to take us back to the starting point.
Well, I was the last one to join the original band. The four of them had already started playing together some. The first two were Mary Gannon and Marla Hunt. They lived in a little apartment in Waller Street, on Waller Street in the Haight. And they, I mean, everybody in the band came from some kind of musical passion. Mary Gannon's background was sort of church music, Irish music, and kind of theater, Broadway and theater. She had gone to, she's from New York, but she went to Monterey Peninsula College down in Monterey, California, in the theater. She was in theater there. Marla came out of a kind of R&B blues rootsy background, gospel. Mary Ellen was raised, she was raised in like Indio, Palm Springs area. And she kind of got started on guitar when she was about 14 and was into folk music and Joan Baez and later blues. But early on, she kind of came up in folk music. She went to a camp up in Idlewild, and there were like great folk players there. You know, there was a whole scene then. It was after blacklisting had died down some, but a lot of people that had been blacklisted were trying to put their lives together. And there were, like, I used to go to there was a preschool, a nursery school in my neighborhood in San Francisco that was kind of a bohemian nursery school, a preschool. It was wonderful. It was called Presidio Hill School. I didn't attend there, but later, when I was probably about seven, I used to go to music events there, including Pete Seeger playing there for the kids. And I remember sitting on his lap and having him sing, "I Know an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Fly," which he would come in there. So a lot of those, you know, iconic players were playing in any places they could in those years coming out of blacklisting, right? So Mary Ellen went to a camp where there were some of those people. Her family were friends with Malvina Reynolds. I don't know if you know who she was, but she was also one of the left-wing socialist early people who, she wrote that song, "Little Boxes on a Hillside, Little Boxes Made of Ticky-Tacky." I don't know if you know that. I think it was about Westlake in San Francisco, but it was just about, you know, and they all look just the same. So anyway, that scene, that was sort of the folk, left-wing folk world. You know?
Like towards the end of the beatnik sort of generation.
And even in it, some of those people were, I mean, they were, you know, I wouldn't say they were beatniks. They were just who they were. They were early folk people, but music people. But they were, you know, they were political. You know, they were political people. And that, you know, which is really a lot where that music, you know, was, I mean, our drummer Diane said to me recently, we were talking, she goes, "Denise, why didn't you go into politics? You know, because I'm really passionate." And I said, well, music and politics were one, you know,
They were.
I was into politics, but I was into, you know, all it was the same, you know, for me, what I was kind of growing up listening to. Let's see who else I was talking to. And then our drummer Diane grew up in San Francisco, and she was a little older than I was, but we both grew up in the same city. But what she was really faced with every time she wanted to play drums, which she did from grammar school, mm-hmm. she was told girls don't get to play drums. They can only play tambourine. So that happened all the way through school with her. Grammar school, junior high, high school, the band teachers or the orchestra teachers say, no, you don't get to play drums. So she didn't get to really start playing her instrument until after she was out of home, you know, out of her home. She actually got married quite young, and her husband was a DJ, and so she got to be in different places, and that's where drummers started to show her things. But they all started playing together. They found each other, and I was the last one to meet up with them. And I had already been in another band. I'd already made a single, a record myself. I'd been in actually other bands before that. So I had never thought of an all women's band ever in my life, but I played a lot. I'd been.
Right.
You know, I was on the bus, right? Do you know that, right?
Yeah. Oh, you were on the bus?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, so, and I, my last 2 years of high school were in Palo Alto. And so I used to go here, because you're talking about the Grateful Dead, because I used to go hear Jerry play in his bands up at the Tangent when I was, you know, 15, 16 in high school. I'd go hear his, you know, bluegrass bands and his, you know, jug bands.
Right.
And when I was graduating from high school, the band that I hired for my graduation party was the Zodiacs, which was Pigpen and Jerry. So I go back with those guys to high school. And then when, you know, later when I met Kesey, which was in June of 65, and got on the bus, my prankster name is Mary Microgram. And so I was on the bus with, you know, Bobby and Mountain Girl, and I were kind of the youngest people on the bus other than Kesey's kids, you know?
Wow.
So, yeah.
Wow. Well, now you see my heart is warming at the same time as I'm completely indebted to you and the Pranksters for developing this culture that I feel a kinship to in such a significant way. So I appreciate those early days, your early days, being on the bus and hanging out with Kesey and Mary Microgram. That's a tremendous nickname.
Yes, that's my Instagram handle too. It's totally my name still.
That's great. So you were Ace of Cups were this quintet that were making music at the same time as The Airplane and Quicksilver and Michael Bloomfield and all of these bands, but you were an all women's band as opposed to, well, the only other woman that had a predominant role, I guess, at the time was probably Janis. I mean, she was the only,
Grace and Janis.
Grace and Janis, right. Yeah, I was going to say Grace as well.
There were bands that started as we were playing. There were bands that we met and became friends with that had women in them, everything from It's a Beautiful Day to The Loading Zone to Joy of Cooking, you know, where they had a mixed group.
Right. But you were the only significant all-female band, right?
The only ones we knew for years.
And what kind of music were you making at the time? Was it that folk rock kind of thing, or was it mostly folk? What was the music that you were making at the time?
We had five lead singers, and we played a lot of in different styles because everyone had different musical influences. So we had, you know, R&B and blues kind of material. We had some folk, more bass. We had definitely some psychedelic rock.
I would expect that from Mary Microgram to have some psychedelic rock.
So, you know, we never felt as though we had to be defined in a particular genre. I mean, there really weren't genres then anyway.
Right.
But we just felt like we could write what we, because mostly, like during the course of the band, we only did cover songs a few times. Very few, very rarely. Mostly everything we did was our own material, and it really spanned, I would say, a lot of different styles, you know.
Fair.
I mean, we were a jazz band, but we actually did play Afro Blue. We explored. We felt very free to explore.
Like most of the bands of that era and of that scene, you know, they were mostly genreless.
I call it transgenre now.
Sorry?
Transgenre?
Sure, transgenre. Or yeah, you know, everybody had their roots, like Jerry had his roots in bluegrass and folk music, but you know, with the advent of psychedelics, that obviously changed, and so all of these bands, Airplane in the same way, were kind of transgenre or genreless, however you want to say it. So you made music from, you know, the mid 60s until the eventual split of the band in 72, yep. If I have that correct.
Yes.
What was it that derailed the band from continuing back in 72? Was there a specific event, or was it just people wanting to go on with their lives and do other things and expand their horizons?
When we say 72, the band was sort of dispersing from like 70 to 72. Mary Ellen left first. She left with her husband, Fred, who managed the Sons of Champlin, to go back to the land and move up to way Northern California. So, you know, I would say what happened was, first of all, we started having children. Right. So Marla had Scarlett in 68, Mary Gannon and Joe had Talina in 69. I had my daughter, Tora, in 70. So we started having children. We didn't get a record deal. So it was harder and harder to put time and energy into something that wasn't financially supporting us well enough for us to be able to make it. You know, we always had to figure out other income streams and things like that, you know.
Right.
So it was difficult, you know. And so we didn't take that next professional step in terms of having a record deal. And I think at a certain point, the demands of children and sort of not being able to take that step at the time, just kind of people went different ways. There wasn't like a big breakup. It was just more and more challenging to try and hold it together.
And it took some 30 years later in 2003, when the anthology of your work was released, the live and demo recordings sort of helped remind people of who the Ace of Cups were and your story and the quintet story and sort of your struggle as a female band in the late 60s to come to the fore again, right? Is that accurate?
Yes. Yeah.
So what happened between 2003 and 2017, when you probably started to work on your debut record, to sort of re-engage everybody in this idea of, well, you're older, so your children are older and your responsibilities as parents have probably started to wane significantly. And so was that it, that you just had more time to come back to this? Or was it that there was an audience interest, a community interest in kind of the message from back in the day and the message today?
What happened was that George Bayer Wallace, who is the started High Moon Records, which is our label, he was a fan of the music of the 60s and the Bay Area music particularly, but just that music of that time, even though he was born many years later. He had seen the name Ace of Cups on posters and had heard, you know, us singing background vocals on different music from the 60s. But when that live tape record came out, It's Bad For You But Buy It, in 2003, that was the first time that George and a lot of other people actually heard us, and we weren't just a name on a poster. Right. At that point, he kind of became a fan of the Ace of Cups. And in about 2010 or so, he reached out and called me and said he was a big fan of our music and he was coming from New York to LA and would I meet him for dinner? And so I did. And he was hoping we had more unreleased tapes that he could release, because his label is more of a reissue label than trying to find gems that hadn't been shared with the world or had gone out of print. But we really didn't have much you know, we'd been schlepping those reel-to-reel tapes around for like 40 years by then. They'd gone through a hurricane. They'd gone through a lot. And Alec Palau, who put that first anthology together, you know, had to do a lot of work to find just that, because there were songs that we had pieces of, you know, there were a lot of songs we never got to record, because those recordings often were just what our road manager, Frank Pulte, would just bring a reel to reel to a stage and put it on the side. And it was just for us to be able to listen to after and go, oh yeah, that bridge really didn't work or whatever it was, you know, we never thought that any of those tapes would be.
You didn't have a Bear or a Betty Cantor Jackson archiving every move that you made.
No. So that being said, when George was looking for old tapes, we ended up going to my house and listening to music all night. I listened to a bunch of things I'd recorded, Ace of Cups stuff that hadn't been heard. So he just really wanted to help us. He was really interested. And then some months later, we got invited to play for Wavy Gravy's 75th birthday at the Craneway Pavilion in the Bay Area with, you know, Bobby Weir and Kim Ock and a bunch of other, Mickey Hart, everybody. Yeah. And we were invited to open the show, and everybody lived in different places and nobody had very much money. And it was like, how are we pull that off? And George said, you guys, if you want to play the show, I'll rent you a house. You can practice for like 12 days. You know, we'll get you a rehearsal studio and we'll make it possible for you to go play that show. And that's what he did. And he came out from New York and he came to that show. And it was when he heard us live, he got more excited. And at that point, so that was May of 2011. So some months later, three of us, Mary Ellen, our lead guitarist, and Diane, our drummer, and myself, wanted to get together and just play. And George said, if you want to get together, I'll help you. So he would, you know, give us a plane ticket or whatever it was to get help everybody get to one place, because we lived in sort of three different parts of California.
Right.
And we started playing every couple of months. We'd get together for 3 or 4 days just to play.
Fun.
And as soon as we started playing, we started writing. So we played old material, we wrote new material. We did that for a couple of years. And somehow around 2014, George said, you just need to go into the studio. You're writing great stuff. I love what you're doing. We'd send him little, you know, MP3s from our iPhones. Listen to this song we're working on, you know. So that's how it happened. We went into the studio about 2015. We found Diane knew Dan Shea, our producer. We were looking for a woman producer for a while. We didn't find one that, we found some, you know, good, obviously highly qualified women, but they were more used to recording bands that had been playing their material for years. You know, they could go in and they could set, you know, but we hadn't been playing it. We were like starting from scratch and we were like pulling up this material, but then how do we arrange it? And what is, so for us, because we hadn't been playing live, we needed a different kind of approach. And Dan Shea was great. He came down to this little rehearsal studio and said everything that we wanted to hear from a producer. So we figured he was our guy. So we started working with him and he went through all of Alec Palau's tapes of us. He went through, listened, just really starting to extract what he thought would be, and obviously with our input, what, you know, where we would start. And that first period, I mean, people were flying in. Mary Gannon was flying in from Hawaii some of the time, and we were driving or flying in from other places. So converging in Marin County to record. And we started out with thinking we would do 12 songs, and then it went to 16, and then it went to 21 and 26. By the time we had like 30 songs recorded, that's when High Moon said, okay, we're going to divide this whole project into a double album to be released in 2018, another album in 2020, and then another one in 2021. So that's our current plan. We still have another album partly done.
What's great too is that many of your colleagues who were around back in the day either play with you on this record or on that first initial record, or are around for this record, you know, people like Jackson Brown, and we mentioned Bobby Weir and Taj Mahal and Yorma and Jack Cassidy. I mean, it really is a who's who of the music scene of Marin, but also of San Francisco and California. And I'm proud as a Canadian to say that even Buffy St. Marie makes an appearance on some of the work.
Buffy is really dear friend, and she lives right a few miles away from where I am right now in Kauai. And I think we're getting together this weekend.
Great.
And Buffy was really, in a certain way, I think was really our first guest on the album. She had come to the Bay Area to play Hardly Strictly Bluegrass. And we said, will you come into the studio on the Sunday after your set and play and sing on this song? And she did. And from that, it kind of opened the door to other people being open to play with us too. I mean, because then Jackson said, we were all together with Jackson, and Buffy said, hey, I just sang on the new Ace of Cups album. And Jackson goes, well, I want to sing on it, you know?
Right.
Things just flowed forward in that way. So we really are grateful to Buffy for, you know, stepping up with us.
It's so nice that egos didn't get in the way at all, that it really was about the music and the message of the music and, yeah, and the, the attitude of the time prevailing, right? The attitude of the late 60s prevailing in 2018 or 2015, whenever it is that you made that first record. Why did you think, from a socio-political point of view, that it was so important for you to step out again with some of the similar messages of your earlier work in 2015? We sort of talked about it a bit off the top before we dived in, but many of the issues, you know, I'm thinking about off the current record, Keb Mo's Put a Woman in Charge. I mean, how important is that? And how poignant is that in 2018, where Kamala Harris is potentially going to be the vice president of the United States? How important are those themes that, you know, we talked about how it's sad. In one way, it's sad. And in one way, it's great that there's an opportunity to still talk about these things. How important is that to the Ace of Cups story?
Really important. First of all, I mean, a lot of the songs on these records are our original songs from that time. Some of them done exactly the way we would have done them live then, you know, and some of them have morphed, and some of them, you know, so we have, some of them are more recently written. But when you think of those times, there were a lot of women artists of all kinds of expression, whether it was, you know, music or painting or poetry or novel, you know, who just were ignored. So those voices and those perspectives and those points of view were not in the mix of the commentary of the time and the observation of the time. And when we even when our first, the live record came out in 2003, and we had, you know, our first little website, people would write to us from all over the world and say, I mean, not like we were the giant hit, but people, you know, people that were into that music and that era found us and heard us, you know, and they were of all ages and genders and people in all, you know, South America, South Africa, or Europe and Asia, and people would find us and just say, I knew there were women's, you know, singing these things or saying something. There were women that had something to say then, but we could never find the women that were saying these things, or, you know, that were, we couldn't find those artists. And so I think it's really important that those voices and those lyrics and what we, who we are and what, you know, are available now. That's the most thrilling part, because all those years, you know, people sometimes ask, were you bitter that you didn't get a record deal? Or, you know, it wasn't bitter. It was just sad because of our music, because we felt as though our songs had something to add to the tapestry of the conversation of that time. And it just wasn't part of it, because people never got to hear it. So that's what's really thrilling about now.
It's kind of like the internet really was the missing link, right, for you, for your message to reach a wider audience and for you to sort of be able to commercialize your music. Because,
well, it was the internet, and before that, it was just, you know, once Alec Palau from Big Beat Records, which is Ace Records out of England, once Alex went through our music, I mean, even just that it was in music magazines in those days, and it was, you know, certainly having a website helped too, but, you know, that people could actually hear that music, that opened up amazing connections for us.
Right, because I think in the nostalgia, the message remains clear that even though, you know, the music is of a different era, the message and the lyrics of the music is certainly as relevant, if not more relevant today than it's ever been, right?
That's what I feel. And, you know, I'm a lyric person. So, yes, I mean, it matters what we're saying. And it matters that there's something authentic about what is all this about, you know, and our psychedelically informed sense of unity and community right. needed to be said then and heard, and it needs to be said now.
Right. So how cool is it that you're sort of with a big break in between living the life that you may have considered for yourself when you were 17 or 18 or 20, that now you're actually getting this message out and more people are listening to this message and people are rising up along with this message and other messages so that this is the focal point of the discussion. And this is the sort of rousing call now at a critically important time, probably as important as it was in the late 60s as it is relevant today in 2020. That your music and your themes are finally being part of the vernacular and the culture of the socio-political time.
I think it's really important and totally cool. And I think, you know, in the old days, the stereotypes that we were busting up just by being who we are, we weren't like going out saying, let's go bust stereotypes. But just because we found each other and we started playing by virtue of who we are, we were, that kind of blew people's minds because they'd never seen it. We'd never seen it, you know?
Yeah.
When we were on those stages, that was, you know, shocking for some people at first, just to see five young women doing what we were doing, saying what we were saying. And now I think the stereotypes that we're breaking up have to do with both sexism, but also ageism.
Right.
And it's kind of fun to be breaking that one up too.
For sure. When you think about bands like, now they're just called the Chicks, not the Dixie Chicks, right, or other female artists who found it incredibly important to empower other women, but empower people as a whole, when was that something that was quickly relatable to you, even though you had been out of the business and even though you had been not necessarily a quote unquote, small quotes, rock star anymore, that you were still akin to these messages and still in tune with what these women who were talking about empowerment, no matter the genre, whether it's Taylor Swift doing her thing or the Chicks doing their thing, whatever, that there was this new sense of women empowerment in rock.
Yes.
Melissa Etheridge is another great example of just people who knew their place in the time that they were making music and thus may have been not necessarily inspired by Ace of Cups in particular, but the idea of Ace of Cups. Was that also a huge thrill for you to see that these people were coming along and sort of breaking the mold of traditional rock and roll and the traditional boundaries of the record industry to create female empowerment around music?
Yes. I mean, I've, you know, obviously watched this progress.
Yeah.
Since those days, you know, when I've talked to women who had radio shows or men who had radio shows in those days, that was the only way you got played in the early days, was if you were on the radio. That was even before there was AM radio, then before FM and then FM. But you know, there were these things like you could only have a woman sing once an hour,
right,
on the radio, right? You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, I talked to people that were like, that was what their program or of their radio station said, right, you know, So, you know, every little step forward is great. And all of the people you mentioned and all of the ones you didn't, you know, everybody from, sure, you know, Dolly Parton to you know, the Go-Go's to you know,
Blondie probably, or
Anais Mitchell is one of my, I love Anais Mitchell. I love, I mean, there's so many wonderful, interesting women now out there doing all kinds of great stuff. It's right. Thrilling. And I just want more, you know, I you know, it's as in the Me Too movement, as in everything, like women's voices need to be heard and their stories need to be told. And they're, you know, and we're all enriched when whoever is marginalized gets to tell their story. Right. And then our vision can expand, if it isn't already, to see a perspective that we never considered because we didn't live that or know that.
The songs that we hear now that are on the 2018 record and on the current record, the 2020 record, they're songs that were written in the past for the most part, right?
No, they're no? All, everything. I mean, some of them are, every single song, we could go song by song. Some of them are original Ace of Cups from the 60s that right. We're doing as close as we can to the way we did them. And some of them are songs from the 60s that we're doing in a totally different way, but the lyrics are pretty much the same. And then there's songs from that we wrote then that we've written a new bridge or new verses and are doing it in a different way. And then there's songs that we've written in the intervening years. And then there's songs that we've written while we were recording.
Right. Yeah. So that's what I was going to get to, is that, you know, the message, not just the message of women empowerment, but probably lots of messages around the earth and human goodness and all of those sorts of things. Those are all current issues. Those are all current discussions of the day. So there's you know, everything old is new again, right? I mean, there's plenty of inspiration just opening the door, not even having to think about. And I hate to, you know, it's so sad that I have to put it that way, but the themes of the 60s and the late 60s, that those are still themes of today. I mean, the things that you were talking about in the
hate. Songs are timely now.
Yeah, right, exactly.
It's not like they're just nostalgic or that was interesting in those times, but we don't have those questions up anymore. No, that's, you know, and it is, you know, there were things that we were standing for in those days that we really thought that humanity and our country would have handled by now. And right. Would have moved beyond, and we would be much farther along in terms of equity and human progress than we are. But here we are. So,
right. Does it at least warm your heart that musicians and your audience is coming back to Ace of Cups, to the music that you made then, to the music that you're making now, to the messages and reapplying those messages in a modern time and trying to get us to a better place? Is that at least, that was the goal then. It must still be the goal and will continue to be the goal to spread good, positive messages and vibes, right?
Yes. I mean, you know, and to call things as they are. Sometimes it's not, you know, it's not all sunshine and roses, baby.
Right.
You know, it's like to be able to really say what's so, be authentic. And also, but, you know, point to our unity, our community, you know, our sense of like, we are in this together. We need to get it together. And so,
these aren't bubblegum pop songs. I mean, these are relevant songs of the day. And unfortunately that day is 1965 to, well, even preceding you, but to right. 2020 as well. Denise, thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for reviving this music. It's so important, especially given the socio-political climate of our time and that we're not over these issues in any stretch of the imagination, unfortunately. And thank you for spending some time with us today to talk about Ace of Cups and all the wonderful work that you're doing. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ira. It's been a pleasure.
What a terrific story spanning several decades. The Ace of Cups' socio-political messaging combined with familiar sounds make them as relevant today as they were some 50 years ago. For more on Ace of Cups, you can visit aceofcups.com. Before we leave you, let's listen to a track off the 2018 pseudo-debut of Ace of Cups. Here is The Well with guest Bobby Weir.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.